Band is War Art, and there are copies of that I know in the bookstore. 2007, Art and War, which is this book here, and 2009, A Brush with War, Military Art from Korea to Afghanistan. Her work details the diverse portrayals of artists and their reactions to the horrors of war. Dr. Brandon.
Good evening. I'm very pleased to be here. I like coming to Vancouver. I have a son here who I don't see very often, so it's good to have an excuse to come. I'm going to talk about a subject which I normally deal with from a Canadian perspective only, but tonight I want to speak about it in a more international context and also from a very much earlier point in time than I usually talk. So hopefully the lights are automatically going to go down and I will begin. But the question that is behind what I'm talking about tonight is, what is war art? People have very different perceptions about what it is. Many historians see it as something that you look out for in order to illustrate a history book. Other people see it as a large form of propaganda. For some people, it's what tells others about their military history. And I'm just going to try and get to grips with some of those differing views on what war art is. Tonight's talk will be divided essentially into three parts. I'm going to look at Western war art, and then specifically at 20th century war art, and then survey Canadian war art to the present day. And the art that's coming out in response to our involvement in Afghanistan. When I was thinking about how to pull my thoughts together, I was in England looking after my mother, who was very ill. And in England, I get to read things that I don't normally read. And one of the things I used to read was a somewhat right-wing journal, which happened to be in my mother's house, lent by a neighbor, called The Spectator. And in it I found a quote by a man who I hadn't known anything about, called Neville Cardus, which I found very pertinent to my interest in art, and I've put that quote up on the screen before you. Cardus is normally associated with writing about cricket. He apparently transformed sports writing on the game of cricket from sort of think about how many runs and how many ducks and all the other things that happen in cricket to almost a poetic form, and writing on cricket hasn't been the same again. But I found this quote, which he applies to art, very significant in terms of war art, because if you put the word war in front of it and then you consider what war art does, the quote works very, very well. Most of the history of Western war art, and I do apologize, I put these things up mostly to help myself, not only you, because I don't like reading. I find it easier to just speak to slides. So I put these things up because I can read them too. But anyway, on Cardus's list, he talks about the things that are fleeting, and war is something that's fleeting. And that's one of the reasons I believe we have war art, to make sure that things like battles and are recorded for posterity. He also speaks about the importance of art's role in achieving immortality for certain aspects of the human condition. And success in war is something that we like to celebrate. Those artworks that come out of war are by and large the product of official patronage, kings, emperors, rulers of one kind and another. And it's a long time in history before there's any switch from that very prominent role of the patron as the producer of war art. So I did say we'd start at the very, very, very beginning, and the very, very, very beginning in art history is cave paintings. And so I popped this drawing up, a rock drawing, because it shows somebody with what looks like either spears or maybe arrows from a bow and arrow. You can never be quite sure. Because it can be argued that perhaps as war is endemic in human society, that some of these seemingly militarized figures that you see in these very, very early works of art are in fact about battle. Largely, these figures appear in association with animals, which suggests that they're about hunting. But since there's no other evidence of what they have to say about either hunting or war, we can't be sure. So I think consideration can be given to the possibility that some of this early art may have something to do with battle. The first examples of war art that we have come quite a long period later, when societies are beginning to settle in certain geographic areas, particularly in the Middle East. And this is an Egyptian piece that anyone who's done first year art history is usually forced to look at, called the Palette of Narmer, which is in the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. And it shows King Narmer, whose great claim to fame was to unify Upper and Lower Egypt. And this is not an area in which I'm expert, but I hope I'm correct. And like many rulers, he wanted what his successes in doing this, which involved a lot of battle, to be reflected in the society in which he lived. So the palette is in fact a makeup dish, and it shows Narmer in the middle, wielding a club and some corpses at the bottom. And he seems to have be in charge about to beat up an enemy at his feet. And essentially, he's extra large to show that he was successful. But right off the bat, you have the ruling. The point about this is that you have the ruler informing the public who have access to visual images in different places, who's the boss, who has been successful. This beautiful thing, the Royal Standard of Ur, is in the British Museum in London, and it is, to my mind, one of the earliest and most beautiful objects that exists that depicts war. The other side depicts peace. And its purpose is not known, but it existed in the Sumerian. It's a Sumerian piece from the area around present-day Iraq, and it shows again a parade. I should be using this gadget if it works, but I'm going to need it on one picture. But you have a parade of armed people going along the top, and then more possibly prisoners coming along here, and then you have some battle chariots and charging horses and so on here. But below the horses you have corpses, so that's why you know it's war. And this image tells a narrative story about what happens in wartime, and again, like the Palette of Narmer, it's used on an object that would have been accessible to a public so that they would know the meaning of war. And as far as we can determine from this object, what it meant for the community that they lived in. The most militaristic society of that time was the Assyrian society, and they have wonderful examples of stonework which depicts war. And this particular piece, which is also in the British Museum, along with the Elgin marbles. That was not supposed to be what happened. And it's not a very good image, but basically what it shows is a parade of prisoners marching along, and then above here is the booty that's been captured in the particular Assyrian battle with which this is associated. And it's from, I believe it's from Nineveh, which is, I think I'm correct there, it's sort of a huge complex where a lot of this sculpture was found, and needless to say, in the mid-19th century, shipped back to Britain, where it still remains. But the point here, again, is that war art is a narrative. The narrative is directed by the success of the victor in the war, and the imagery consolidates the power base of the particular victor. When we get to the Greeks, the quality and three-dimensionality of the image, of course, becomes quite superior. And this is one of the most extraordinarily beautiful monuments in the West at the moment. It's in the Pergamon Museum in Berlin. I used to hear of this when I was young, and I never saw it until East and West Berlin were joined together and you could go and see it. This is a part of a frieze that you find on the monument. It's about 3 meters high, I guess. And it's very, very long, but it shows a battle between the gods and the giants. And it captures, unlike the previous pieces I've shown you, a sort of narrative of battle, it captures the moment at which the gods are triumphant. And it's in terms of war art, it's one of the earlier examples where you see religion and war becoming very closely aligned, which they remain until the present day. Except in this case, religion is represented by the gods who are triumphant. But the gods of future generations are also handmaidens and handmen to the success of those who wish to achieve power through battle. And out of war art, you also get this different, larger forms of public commemoration. And this is part of Trajan's Column, which is in Rome. And Trajan celebrated his victory over the Dacians at the beginning of, well, it's around 103 AD, I think, by coming up with the idea of this a column, which has, instead of, as we saw in the Standard of Ur, kind of a comic strip just on either side, the storyline twirls around the column up to the top. And what is notable about it is that Trajan himself turns up, I think, something like 50 times on the surface of the column, so it doesn't matter where you look at it and from what angle, you're always going to be well aware that this particular series of battles was successful because of one particular emperor who consolidated power as a result of his success, which is represented by this visual art form, the column. And it's interesting that as a form of war art, the victory column continues through the next several thousand years. Napoleon, of course, had one erected in Paris as well. Then come the Dark Ages, and you don't see huge, massive columns, you don't see victory arches, you don't see sculptural programs associated with battle, but what you do see in the surviving visual art records that we have, and in this case, this is a page from something called the Utrecht Psalter, which is in the Netherlands, the Utrecht Psalter is the Psalms of David, so all the Psalms of David are in there, but illustrated with these lovely little pen and ink drawings by a series of artists. And this is Psalm 20, which is the psalm considered to be a prayer for victory. And what you see in this page is battle between different groups here. It's a little difficult to understand. The success and crowning of the victor here and overlooking the whole thing, the Christ figure with all the angels. So right off the bat, if you're going to pray for victory, there's a close association between the conduct of battle, the success of battle, and having God on your side. And as you know, all the way through into the First World War, particularly, the idea of God being on one or other side, or on both sides usually, continues and is part and parcel of how war is depicted in art. It has a huge religious dimension. After the Dark Ages, so to speak, come to a close, and the Emperor Charlemagne comes into power around about 900 AD. The dynamics of war art change again. And in a way, they go backwards in time. And so this is a part of the Bayeux Tapestry, which was created by needlewomen after William the Conqueror successfully defeated Harold at the Battle of Hastings in 1066. And this is rather like the Trajan's Column, imagery of Trajan's Column, but laid out in a straight line. It's the most extraordinary thing to go and see because it's very, very long, about 2 foot 6 inches wide, and you follow the narrative of these wonderful of the whole journey from the beginning to the end of the conquest of England, beginning with William getting his troops together. Then they cross the Channel, and then they land, and then they fight, and then Harold gets an arrow in his eye, and so on and so forth. And it runs very much like the Standard of Ur, which makes you wonder about how things recycle over and over again. But you have the basic storyline going endless along in the middle column. Then, as we've seen elsewhere down below, you have sort of defeat represented. Here's a poor headless soldier, and other things to do with battle, like here's a sword and shield that probably belong to the headless chap here, and bows and arrows and so on. And then up above, it's very difficult to know exactly what the function is of these images, but some of them can perhaps be considered symbolic. And that's an element that, again, becomes part and parcel of explaining the content of war art, is that symbols are used where some abstract aspects are harder to understand. But the point of the Bayeux tapestry, as was the point of Trajan's Column, as was probably less the point of the Standard of Ur, but certainly the point of the Palette of Narmer, is to commemorate success in battle and to immortalize the person that led to that success. Now, I love doing this. You just skip over hundreds of years. We're into the Renaissance now. We've left William the Conqueror long way behind and his descendants quarreling away in Britain, and moved to Florence, where people associated with the Medici princes, of course, quarreling away like mad as well. And this painting you normally look at in art history because it's an example of an early use of perspective with the artist Paolo Uccello trying to sort of get the soldiers looking as though they're going that way, and then making the action in front much larger than the action behind. And if you follow the lines through here, for example, going along there, you're sort of going off to a vanishing point and so on. But its significance here is twofold. First of all, yet again, regardless of the society in which you find art, there's a lot of battle painting in it, and that battle painting has to do with commemorating success, and this painting is about commemorating a successful battle on the part of the city-state of Florence. It's also a very significant piece because it became one of the most famous battle paintings for a number of centuries, to the extent that during the First World War, when the British were setting up their official war art program and wanted a series of commemorative canvases, they took this painting as the measure of the size of the commemorative canvases they wanted. This Renaissance painting was considered what battle painting, what war art should be. But it's not just art and embroidery and columns that commemorate war visually and ensure that the successes of the past are immortalized forever and that the fleeting battles of times gone by are remembered. This is Blenheim Palace in England that was built, well, the land was given to the Duke of Marlborough because of his success in Europe at the Battle of Blenheim. And the palace was built over a number of years. And then many decades after the battle and the palace, the battle was over, the palace had been built, a landscape architect called Capability Brown was hired to redo the gardens, to re-landscape the grounds that surrounded Blenheim Palace. And they were landscaped to match the positions of the troops at the actual battle. and the trees were planted to match where the various groups of soldiers and the various forces were placed. So it's an example of an entire landscape being transformed into a commemorative work of art, but using a medium that we haven't seen in use up until that point in time. I don't believe the sheep have any function in the scene at all. But it is interesting that sheep do turn up in war art quite a lot. There are many sheep around Vimy Ridge, for example. But they're there to keep the grass down, as I think they are here as well. Anyway, war art quite clearly has a major role to play in creating public expectations, confirming political viewpoints, asserting power, all these sort of things that that matter in societies that are on the up. To the extent that when Britain is successful in the Seven Years' War in conquering Canada, and Wolfe dies on the battlefield, this massive painting, The Death of Wolfe, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, is commissioned about a decade after and completed by Benjamin West. And it's a notable work of art for a number of reasons. One of them is simply on the basis of that combination of religion and war art that I referred to before, because here Wolfe looks as though he's just been taken off this sort of cross-like form. So if you were well aware of images of the descent from the cross, you would see Wolfe being equated with the Christ figure. The piece is also notable for the fact that it bears absolutely no resemblance whatsoever to what actually happened. Wolfe did not die romantically like this on the battlefield at all, and the majority of the people that are depicted in the painting were not there either. Rumor has it that they paid to be included. The significance of this battle painting is that the battle was considered important, and if you wanted to be considered important yourself, you made damn sure that you were in the painting too. And this painting also had significance because it was reproduced. Wolfe was probably the most marketed dead person in that Britain had ever seen in the last quarter of the 18th century. Images taken from this painting and from others of him, largely all done after he died, were transformed into everything from mugs to pipes to dishes to embroidery to all sorts of souvenir and touristy type items that spread the word that here was a hero and that this hero had died in the service of his country and his country was busily expanding its empire. So there were a number of sort of interlocking roles played by this work of art. And it continues to be an enormously powerful work of art. There are about 8 copies of large size. One is in the National Gallery of Canada, and I believe it is the most popular painting in the National Gallery of Canada in terms of any visitor survey that's ever been done, which tells us that the Group of Seven have a long way to go. It set the standard for this kind of war art. It becomes very, very sophisticated, very dramatic, and ever more enormous. And this is a painting done for Napoleon, which is now in the palace at Versailles, by Antoine Jean Gros, better known as Baron Gros. And it shows Napoleon on a white steed after he successfully deals a blow to the Turks while he's trying to take over Egypt at the Battle of Aboukir. The French, at the beginning of the 19th century, were masters of war art. And there, I think, can be no doubt that Napoleon's fame, probably to the present day, rests on the enormous number of paintings that were conceived and painted during the course of the 19th century, which depict him as the ultimate hero, the ultimate action man of his time, blowing everything before him. But it's a form of war art which comes into being quite swiftly, has a century's duration, and then falls by the wayside, defeated ultimately by photography. And the other thing that comes into play is the power that the ruler, the patron, can exert over what is war art is affected by a shift towards the significance in the artist and what the artist can contribute to the creation of war art. And it's when that shift happens, when the artist starts to determine what war art is as opposed to the king or the ruler, the emperor, whatever, that you have the other part of that quotation I showed you from Neville Cardus, that it is illuminated, because it's the power of the individual artist to make sense of the more abstract aspects of battle, of things like fear, of terror, of the pain of death, that the things that you cannot give meaning, that have no meaning in terms of mere illustration, that you can't measure violence, for example. It's when artists take control, so to speak, of those, making those abstract forces visible, that the shift moves away from the patron to the individual human being. It ultimately is expressed as anti-war art, and anti-war art's own history is relatively lengthy, and it crops up in very surprising places. This is a painting by Peter Paul Rubens, a Flemish artist associated with his luxurious nudes for the most part. And he also worked as a diplomat, and this painting is called Minerva, I should be able to read this, Protecting Peace from Mars. But basically what it's about, it was a piece of propaganda, and all this stuff in here, it's Minerva showing what wonderful things come with peace, you know, happy families and lots of luxurious items and so on and so forth. And what you get in the background here is what happens when you have war. You get dark clouds and violence and so on and so forth. So the point of this work of art is to act as, in a funny sort of way, a protest against having any more war in Europe. And that was the point of the diplomatic mission to the British court. On a smaller scale, you get prints, which circulate more widely than paintings are and address a different kind of audience, normally a middle class as opposed to an aristocratic audience. And these are, other than Goya's Disasters of War, the most depressing series of war art prints that exist to this day. And they were made by a printmaker called Jacques Callot in response to the 30 Years' War. And there's a series of about 18, I think, and they're tiny. They're less than the size of a postcard. And what they depict, all of them, is the consequences of war, not the success of battle or the land won through war or any of the booty of that comes with victory, but what people do to each other in war and what the consequences are for ordinary people through whose land and villages war comes. So this particular piece is called The Hanging, and it's pretty explicit because there are all the hanged people that the military captured who are all surrounding them. But the part, of course, that's most, to my mind, that's most distressing of this scene is the priest up here on the ladder blessing the hanged victims. The irony of the series of prints was that all the early ones, or the first grouping, all deal with the terrible effects of war, And then the final print shows these troops being provided with the rewards of battle in the form of the booty that has been captured, which is rather an ironic commentary on the whole thing. And this, of course, takes us straight to Goya. And this is plate 15, I believe, from the Disasters of War series that he made in Spain at the beginning of the 19th century in direct response to the war between France and Spain that was taking part, taking place in the peninsula. And the series of images is notorious for its graphic violence, particularly the violence affected on women and by women during the conflict. And in this particular scene, you have an execution squad at work. And you see a series of people that have been shot attached to the post behind, and then this person is still standing. Here is an earlier victim. You see this dehumanized group of the shooting squad, and then another group here. These prints Goya was aware of, even in his own lifetime, were too inflammatory to circulate, and so they were not actually printed beyond the proof stage until 1863, which was 50 years after they were first made, and then in a limited edition, and then the more widely available edition wasn't made until 1903, which just shows you how long it took before images like this were accepted in as circulating works of art. And I mentioned already that photography revolutionized war art, and the reason it revolutionized war art was because the nature of the medium implied that it was more truthful, that there was so little between the moment of taking the photograph and the scene that was captured by the photograph that photography had to be the truth. This has been up for debate ever since, but there's no doubt that some photographs did have an amazing effect and continue to have an amazing effect on war art, because photography was able to support that quote that I referred to from Cardus, that it made things that you didn't believe you could ever capture for eternity or immortalize. It made that possibility even more real if war art was what you wanted to, or war and battle were what you wanted to immortalize. The earliest military photographer is Roger Fenton, who goes to near the Black Sea during the Crimean War to capture the British in battle. He finds that the equipment he has is too cumbersome to take anything particularly interesting. He's also somewhat constrained in terms of what he can do, so all his photographs consist of groups of soldiers standing around, not looking particularly put out by war, which makes one wonder about where Florence Nightingale was when he was about, and these extraordinary landscapes of battle. And debate centers on whether he created the scenes that you see and the meaning that was put into them. This is supposed to be where the Light Brigade charged before they were mown down. And but the story is that all these pieces of ammunition that are scattered around like so many sort of skulls almost were actually largely moved into position by Fenton in order to suggest what was understood to have happened in the charge, with this sort of total destruction of the armed service personnel and their animals, their horses, and that he moved so many of the cannonballs there to equate with the level of destruction and the number of people that were killed. But it's impossible to interview Roger Fenton today, so we will never know conclusively whether he did that or did not. Of course, the American Civil War produced Matthew Brady and the photographers associated with him. This one is Timothy O'Sullivan, who in fact produced most of the more depressing photographs of that particular battle. These photographs were in relatively wide circulation, largely through being reproduced in magazines like Harper's Weekly. But the extraordinary thing about it is that up until 1870-odd, you could see them. And then the photographer, nobody wanted to know about them anymore, and the photographer went bankrupt. So the period of time in which these rather violent images were visible was very, very short. They disappeared. And much like Goya's prints, the violent side of war was sort of kept under the table in a very Victorian-type fashion, sort of hidden under the tablecloth, invisible to general view, but not completely forgotten because they were resurrected eventually to become iconic images of people's understanding of that particular tragic conflict. But the impact of photography was to change what paintings looked like. And this is particularly apparent in the work of a British artist called Elizabeth Thompson, or Lady Butler, who was the best-known military artist of the end of the 19th century in Britain. She grew up or developed as an artist thinking that the French glorious paintings, the Napoleonic charges and so on, were the ultimate in war art. But she also knew that there was damage on the battlefield. And this painting, The Roll Call, became her most famous work because it was painted years after, but it was about the Crimean War. But it included not just surviving soldiers, but this rather saddened group here, and in fact one on the ground who hadn't made it through. So the idea that war was not always a glorious venture, but was something in which tragedy was also very significant, begins to carry weight, a weight that's added to by the evidence of photography. The 20th century is the century in which Cardus's commentary comes together as a whole, and it's his century, and it's maybe that his comments on art are also reflective of what the 20th century was, which was an extraordinary time. I find it hard to believe even now that we're not in it anymore, and that it's history, because it is such a big century in so many ways. And I've spoken already about what I felt the rise of the artist meant in terms of art, or in terms of war art, about being the artist having the capacity to deal with the incomprehensible and to have the ability to make real that which was impossible to really measure, to really understand. And that, I think, is the achievement of the war artists of the 20th century, because they were faced in the First World War with a loss of life that was totally unbelievable, could not have been thought about, even imagined, prior to that particular war. The other thing that comes out of the First World War is this huge desire on the part of those that participated and those that were left, that not only should they understand what caused the enormous loss of life, the millions of dead, but also how could they permanently remember, as we do today. I mean, I'm wearing my poppy, as are many of you. But war art has a role, an enormous role to play in how we remember those conflicts of nearly a century ago. And I put a couple of cemetery pictures in because I find that that's really the only way in which I can understand numbers. War art actually doesn't do the numbers for me. It's the cemeteries. And you can argue that the way they're designed is also a part of war art, because they're largely the First World War British ones are the work of Edwin Lutyens, who admittedly was an architect first and foremost, but was also extremely sensitive to art and in a sort of interdisciplinary way. For example, his houses were often co-designed with the landscape architect Gertrude Jekyll, to create an overall a complex imagery that brought together home and environment. And she was also involved to a little bit with the design of the cemeteries on the Western Front. But this is one of the largest. It's the Tyne Cottis near Passchendaele, or where Passchendaele. Various battles were fought near Ypres. And memorials, too, take on another form, and they're a form of war art. And this is Edwin Lutyens' great memorial at Tiepval, which is the equivalent of our Vimy Ridge. It contains on its base the names of all the British soldiers who died in France, who have no known grave. And there are 72,000 names on this particular memorial. And it's not just a place that you put names, but it's a work of art. It's a work of art that commemorates individuals as well as a nation's effort. So it's a public memorial. So it has the role of the patron is there in the form of the British government in terms of funding its construction. But it's also a personal memorial on the part of the artist, Lutyens, who sought to make concrete, or in this case, more brick, the need for a nation to remember its dead. But the First World War produces a mixed kind of art, because art itself is changing. And in Italy, the futurist movement comes to play, and they're fascinated by the military. And in this particular work by Gino Severini, you actually see a train speeding along, being transformed almost into a gun barrel in its own right, and blazing from it are these gun barrels with lots of smoke and action and so on. And the figures here, who are also shooting, have been reduced to a kind of automaton. This is mechanistic war, which is one of the features of the First World War, but immortalized in art. You could argue that this isn't war art because it's not functioning as a commemorative piece, but it is war art because it tells you about the conduct of war and how people thought what they thought it meant in terms of how it was conducted. In this case, it's that it's a mechanistic and rather exciting thing. Others, like the American artist John Singer Sargent, took a less dramatic view of war and looked at the human cost. This is one of the paintings the British commissioned for a memorial building that was never built. In fact, it's the only large-scale painting they commemorate that was ever completed. And it's now in the Imperial War Museum, where it has a room of its own. But its focus is on the consequences of war, as opposed to Gino Severini's celebration of the machinery of war. But some artists felt that you couldn't make that enormous loss of life and that enormous human suffering visible by using the human form, that it was bigger than any human or group of humans. And the artist that is most associated and most achieved this was Paul Nash, who was a soldier, was wounded, became an official British war artist, and decided that the landscape itself could tell you something about war. He abstracted the experience of millions by transforming it into this sort of bleak landscape in which the dead trees almost stand in for the innumerable people that never came back from this ghastly, churned-up area of Northern Europe. In Germany, they had similar reactions to war in their art. And in some cases, it was an ironic response. And this is by an artist called George Gross, who reduced the commented on the irony that they were so desperate at the end of the war for people to serve that they were quite prepared to pronounce a skeleton fit for service. So here's the doctor listening to the heart of the skeleton and saying that the skeleton is going to be fine and a useful soldier to send off to the battlefield. But it's after the war that you see German art comment on the loss of life that, for example, Sargent has commemorated in his painting Gast, or Nash has commemorated in his painting of the churned up landscape with the trees. And Otto Dix paints Flanders 20 years later and shows a German landscape familiar to many in the background through paintings by famous German artists like Adam Elsheimer, with glorious skies. And into this landscape, he allows it to slowly deteriorate into what he remembered as a soldier of the dead and the wounded in the churned up ground. So it's this point when you see the ground, in this case a bit more figurative than that of Paul Nash, but you see the destroyed trees and the sort of churned up quality, that you realize that both victor and enemy have quite a lot in common in terms of their personal responses to the enormity of what they have been involved in. The Spanish Civil War introduces Picasso into the annals of war art. And Guernica is not a piece in a form that we are familiar with up until this point in time. It is a piece of anti-war art. Picasso painted it in direct response to the bombing of Guernica during the Spanish Civil War. And immediately it was arranged that it would be displayed in the Spanish Pavilion at the Paris Exposition of 1937, where it was met with significant acclaim. And because of the way Picasso had designed it, and probably deliberately in a sort of poster-like black and white format, it was reproduced. It was never shown in Spain. Picasso said that the painting could never be in Spain until Franco had gone, so it didn't make it to Spain until 1975. In fact, it spent quite a lot of time in the United States at the Museum of Modern Art. But other than Goya's Disasters of Wars, it's probably one of the best known anti-war statements in the world today. The most famous photograph of the Spanish Civil War is Robert Capa's dead loyalist militia man, or at the moment of death. This, like so much war photography, even the Roger Fenton I showed you, has been the subject of debate as to whether the man was actually being killed, being shot, whether he was tripping over a wire, whether it occurred on the battlefield or behind the lines. And the jury seems to be fairly certain now that the man was not actually shot, that it was a setup. But the point about it isn't so much what happened in reality, but what it represents. And it becomes very problematic for war art from now on in, that it's questioned whether what stands in as the commemorative piece or the documentary piece or the piece that explains abstract concepts to do with fear, death, violence, and whatever, whether when you look at them, when they mean that to you as a viewer, whether that actually is what's happened, to what degree are you being manipulated into thinking that's what's happening? And that business of manipulation in wartime, and at this point you have the patron versus the artist almost in conflict themselves, becomes very prominent in war art from this moment on. Its legitimacy as a faithful record of the nature of war is questioned over and over and over again. And it's ironic that this happens as a result of a photograph that in its initial stages was viewed as the absolutely ultimate example of accuracy of what war was about. So, the Second World War, these debates perhaps go into abeyance for a while, and this is a British work by Dame Laura Knight, showing the degree to which war art could be seconded by the government authorities in the interests of propaganda. And this piece shows Ruby Loftus doing a complicated piece of machine working to demonstrate that women could do men's jobs just as well in the factories. It was not popular with a lot of working men as a subject. They didn't believe she could do a good job. And a lot of women were very suspicious about why she was hired to be the subject and claimed it was because she was prettier than everybody else. And so there was much debate about whether she could actually do it and whether she was just a pretty face, and they made it all up that she could do it. Works like this showed a completely different view. This is Paul Nash, who did the trees in the First World War landscape, thinking about what war meant to him in terms of the British landscape that he loved. And so he painted this painting called Totes Meer, which shows a sea of downed aircraft littering the landscape under this very dark moon, to speak about the destruction of war yet again, but in a Second World War context. So when you contrast it with Laura Knight, you get these two completely opposing views about what war art is. For one, it's very depressing. For the other, it's positive in terms of showing what can be achieved in society. In Germany, there is an official war art program, and it produces a lot of art that looks like the Canadian Second World War official art program. But after the war, you get reflective pieces that question what the Second World War actually meant for Germany. And this is a piece by Anselm Kiefer called Twilight of the West, which utilizes the railway lines here to comment on what Germany was involved in during the war, namely the Holocaust. And of course, even to this day, memorials to the Holocaust remain subjects of huge debate and huge concern in Germany. And you have as many memorials of a public nature like this, you also have anti-memorials, hidden memorials, which speak to the degree to which so much German history remains yet to be discussed, understood, and examined. Vietnam War is a period of huge, as you all probably know, huge protest, which is shown in art by artists like Nancy Spiro, who in her anti-war art equated the destruction meted on the Vietnamese by the Americans with male violence, as in this particular piece. Her husband, Leon Golub, transformed that violence onto the painted surface, creating works of art where he actually attacked the surface of the canvas, painted over it to heal it, and then attacked it again to make reference to wounds that were continually opened over time. And of course, the photography of Vietnam. And this is a photograph of the My Lai massacre, was transformed into propaganda posters that achieved wide circulation. In the Cold War, the mass reproduction of images of war art and the recycling of familiar images is an aspect that takes on some force. Collages were known in the First World War and the Second World War, but this is an example by a British anti-cruise missile artist in which he takes a famous painting by Constable down in Suffolk and the Heywain, and puts cruise missiles on it to show the impact of cruise missile infestation, so want a better word, in the bucolic British countryside. And this was this art image was transformed into postcards and posters and And even the Labour Party arranged for, I think, 20,000 reproductions to be circulated at one point of time, because, of course, it was a Conservative government that brought in the cruise missiles or approved them in the first place. And Britain, again, in war art, becomes very, very different. And this is a particularly difficult painting. And the irony of this painting is that it comes under, was commissioned by the Imperial War Museum as part of their official war art program. And it's a rape scene. It's probably the only rape scene that exists in war art that was officially commissioned, because things like that, atrocities of any kind, were not the sort of subject that any official program ever wanted, because it was not something that the public was particularly keen on knowing about, and certainly did not bring honor and glory upon those that were involved. In the 21st century, you see some of the old art being revisited. And this is an Afghanistan image by an official war artist, war photographer, not a photojournalist, hired by the Imperial War Museum. And he's transformed Roger Fenton's photograph of the battlefield in the Crimean battle, where the charge of the Light Brigade occurred, by replacing the cannonballs here in an Afghani landscape with IEDs, improvised explosive devices. And here we have the Chapman brothers seemingly desecrating a print by Goya, the one I showed you before, by putting on clown faces, actually scratching them into the prints, painting them into the prints. But the point they're trying to make is that you can't look at war art and say, oh, well, that happened in the past, that's not part of my life today. The point they're making is that we revisit and revisit. It's anti-war art. We're revisiting and revisiting the same horrors in our own time. And in order to make that realistic, they change something that is in history to the present day, to bring back the fact that we are repeating experiences from the past. And of course, Iraq has produced appalling sights, and poster art that questions involvement there. Finally, I'm going to look at Canada, and look at Canada in the context of what I've shown you before. This is one of the cemeteries near Beaumont-Hamel. Try to see what time it is. Okay. And this is a quilt that was made after the First World War. I'm just giving you an idea of some of the different art forms that exist that commemorate. In Canada, as elsewhere, the First World War is the first major battle Canada's involved in. And we get the traditional art, and we get the less traditional art in the form of A.Y. Jackson. And Jackson's art is inspired by the precedent of Paul Nash. So there's a very tight link between what's happening in Britain and what's happening in Canada. And of course, we get Varley saying, what were we doing there in the first place? An almost anti-war piece of art based on, as you can see here, photographs from the Canadian Expeditionary Force official photographs. All Canada's war art is intended for a building that's never built. This is was supposed to be built where the National Gallery now stands. And the building isn't built, and a lot of lobbying is required before a Second World War art program is founded. Mackenzie King seems to be a bit leery of war art programs and doesn't say yes that he will fund such a thing until December 1942. And the kind of war art that comes out of the Second World War art has that same multiplicity of dimension that makes it very difficult to say exactly what it is all the time. So here you have a piece by Paul Goranson, who lived for many years here in Vancouver, of RCAF airman map reading in association with their work up in Kiska. Very heroic piece, the sort of thing that the air marshals and co. would have been very happy to see. And then you have Jack Nichols, who passed away a couple of weeks ago, painting a drowning sailor, which isn't heroic at all, but speaks of human experience. So with the Goranson, you have very much art that speaks to the needs of the patron, in this case, the Canadian government. And with the Nichols, a work of art that speaks very much to what the artist himself wanted to say about war. Two completely different kinds of war art. The Korean War adds another dimension. It's the commemorative dimension. There are no war artists in Korea, so Ted Zuba, who was a sniper during that war, decides on the 25th anniversary of the war that he will paint commemorative paintings to honor the people he served with, and this is one of them. It's enormously popular. The commemorative war art is popular, generally. So he's hired later on to go to the Gulf War and become the official artist there under a program called CAFCAP, which stands for the Canadian Armed Forces Civilian Artist Program. In its early days, it includes a huge range of war art. In this instance, they hired a man called Ken Stacey, who went on board Aurora aircraft that were patrolling over the Atlantic, and he was a comic book artist, something that hadn't been used in official war art before. But in Cyprus, they went more traditional and went for an artist who relied largely on photographs to get the geography and machinery of peacekeeping in Cyprus correct. But cruise missile testing in Canada had the same effect as it had had in Britain, and an artist called John Scott produced a number of protest works, including one that was used in a protest parade in Hamilton, in which he painted a cruise missile life-size on a banner that was carried during the protest. And here's the Zuba I was telling you about that was when he was the Gulf War artist. In Croatia, Canadians did not paint rape scenes, but an artist called Bill McDonnell thought very significantly about some of the other precedents in war art that he'd been exposed to try and explain the meditative quality he found about seeing battle in a very European and a very settled environment, and the sort of juxtaposition of tragedy with sort of the idea of a civilized nation. And he turned to Anselm Kiefer for a lot of his ideas. And you can see in this comparison how Kiefer here is considering the Nazi past. And here McDonnell is using the same sort of compositional format to comment on the effects of war in a historically ancient landscape. Somalia, of course, produces another combination of difficulties for war art that challenge its easy definition. The official war artist, Alan McKay, paints the Somali way of life and compares it with the technology of the Canadian soldiers. Finds out when he gets back to Toronto that Shadane Arone has been tortured and killed in the very place he has been working, and paints a series of opaque works that deal with how you can be in a place and not know what's going on, that you have to leave it to find out what's going on and piece it together from newspapers and so on. And Gertrude Kearns in Toronto, nowhere near Somalia, paints a searing diptych based on the photos that she found in Maclean's that are now amazingly in the Canadian War Museum's collection, and commemorate an event in Canadian military history that probably many people hoped would be forgotten, but perhaps that is the function of war art, to ensure that the historical record remains complete. But that's only achievable if the work is collected, remembered, and kept. 9/11 starts a new challenge for war art in that it becomes very difficult because 9/11 affects everybody. Is it Canadian art if it's not a Canadian event, but a Canadian artist has depicted it? And this was the problem we had at the War Museum with this particular piece here by an artist called Elaine Goebel. It was 5 years before it came into the collection, because after 9/11, the implications of what that meant for Canada were only fully understood over time. And it wasn't until it was realized that the impact was affecting Canada dramatically that it was legitimate to bring a painting about an event that had happened on American soil into the collection, even though the artist herself was Canadian and was responding to a military event. So there's a dimension there where the patron, which I guess in effect is the institution I work for, does, much like the kings of the past, affect what constitutes war art in terms of choosing what should be kept and what should be discarded. This piece, in its preliminary drawing form, was not brought into the collection. It's a work by Gary Neal Kennedy, very conceptual, dealing with the failure of intelligence at the beginning of the war in Iraq. But that does not constitute a Canadian subject, even though the artist is Canadian. Now, the current program is called CFAP, Canadian Forces Artist Program, and it's producing a huge range of war art, because the art that comes out of that program doesn't have to be collected. The artists can do whatever they like. If they're accepted into the program, they get sent somewhere. Sometimes it's Afghanistan, sometimes it's Esquimalt, and they paint what they want, and they do with what they want with what they produce. So this is Doug Bradford, who's from Sault Ste. Marie, painting in Esquimalt in a fairly representational way. And this is Ho Tam, painting in Esquimalt, taking photographs in Esquimalt, and then creating complete fictions from that which he photographed, which raise a huge issue. He's in a service that is going to be involved in a war, and he has the opportunity to depict that. He takes a photograph, but he makes a fictional story from his photographs, even though they're based on a reality that he experienced. And I don't know whether that's war art, really, or not. In a way, I think it is, because it's the response of an individual to a set of circumstances, but it's certainly not a documentary response. It's documentary to the extent that it's at sea. He's at sea, and there's water, and there's a ship, and there's sailors, but it's not documentary in terms of the interpretation he puts on it. But in doing that, he's taking the role of the artist that little step further by saying, I, as the artist, can make of what I have seen what I like, and I don't care whether it's true or false. I've made a story from what I have seen, which is almost sort of the other side of propaganda, but from the artist's point of view. And in Gagetown, New Brunswick, we have Scott Waters painting a soldier. I'm wondering whether, if that soldier goes off to Afghanistan and gets killed, whether he should repaint the portrait so that it meets more what he believes the official patron, in this case, the Department of National Defense, would expect of a dead hero. Is this the sort of format you need for a dead hero, or do you have to change it? In Afghanistan, Gertrude Kearns of the diptych paints Paul Franklin as a medic, and after his legs are blown off in a nasty accident involving an IED. And she paints that painting officially, and then goes back to Toronto and paints a completely different work in a form, sort of cathartic exercise, in which you see here Franklin with this great X marking his leg. And that raises issues about whether you, in fact, can paint things like this, whether you're running into an ethical and moral problems when you start to paint people quite so dramatically, much like the rape scene from the British collection. And here you can see how she's used the same image in the two versions and how incredibly different they are, even though they're based on the same. It was a photograph in this particular case. But the response is so different. One is personal, and one is painted as if she was expected to paint the scene. Now I'm just coming to the end. I've talked a bit about photography, and the War art is changing dramatically now because of new technologies. And I've got three pictures to show you. This is by a man called Stephen Andrews. And they're all basically based on what you can pick up off your cell phone, off the internet. And none of the art, these three artists I'm going to show you briefly, have ever been in a war zone. But they are responding to war based on the way we are all responding to war, which is what we see on television, what we can get off the internet, what people tell us, what we see, not through lived experience. But that experience that we're picking up is now so very immediate and so unmediated by any form of censorship, really, for want of a better word, that what we receive is not that different from what somebody on the spot receives, to the extent that the British Broadcasting Corporation, the BBC, is now actively involving the public in producing the images it needs for its broadcasts. So it's no longer the broadcaster getting the images and saying, this is what you should understand by war. It's they actually ask viewers to send in their images, and then they broadcast them as what is what they determine the image of war should be. And that's what artists of this kind are doing now. They're transforming the imagery that they receive about war from all these sources into a common understanding of what it is. And in this case, Andrew Morrow is creating, much like Hotam did, complete fictions. And yet we can look at these images and see aspects of what we think war art should be, and he paints massive paintings with heroic figures and so on, but they're taken from cartoons, they're taken from films, they're taken from a mass of media, and they create the illusion of an important event taking place, but it's just a collage of a whole bunch of experiences, much as we would pick them up if we were channel shifting. And finally, this is a painting which we don't know where it is. We have no idea what it depicts, but so visually acute is the average person now in terms of their understanding of concepts associated with war, whether it's hero, refugee, dead person, graveyard, battlefield, or whatever, that this artist doesn't even have to have a specific place. He doesn't even have to say where the scene is for it to be understood as a piece of war art. So I wanted to finish with the quote again and speak, just remind you that I believe that what war art's achievement is, regardless of the form it takes, is that it stays that which is fleeting. It makes it possible for us to linger on the things about, to linger on the concept of war. It helps us to think about what war means to us nationally and personally. It helps us to understand that which is very difficult to understand. And it helps us to imagine things that we can never experience for ourselves. And it also helps us to make permanent that which has happened in our own immediate pasts. And the last thing, slide is another quote, which I really leave as a kind of question. It was in a book which just came out. It's a British book. And it talks about art, but I think it applies to war art. So I will add the word war. War art is a kind of knowledge after the fact, a description of what cannot be known until it is lived, by which time it is too late to know it. And I guess if I had to sum up what I would think the problematic was with war art is that I'm not convinced in its entire history that it has managed to overcome the last phrase in that particular quote, in that I don't think it has managed to achieve any effect in terms of staying the future conduct of war. Its history shows that war has continued regardless of the things that war art has achieved. So that's the end. So thank you very much.
We will take some questions. Are there some questions? There's one here.
Do you have any comment about the extension of